Chapter 2. Is that connected with the prevalent notion of the sovereignty of the states? We do not believe that the several states of this union are, in any legitimate meaning of the term, sovereign at all. We are fully aware that this will be regarded as a bold, and possibly as a presuming proposition, but we shall endeavor to work it out with such means as we may have at command. We lay down the following premises as too indisputable to need any arguments to sustain them, viz. The authority which formed the present Constitution of the United States had the legal power to do so. That authority was in the government of the states, respectively, and not in their people in the popular signification, but through their people in the political meaning of the term, and what was then done must be regarded as acts connected with the composition and nature of governments, and of no minor or different interests of human affairs. It being admitted that the power which formed the government was legitimate, we obtain one of the purest compacts for the organization of human society that probably ever existed. The ancient allegiance, under which the colonies had grown up to importance, had been extinguished by solemn treaty, and the states met in convention, sustained by all the law they had, and backed in every instance by institutions that were more or less popular. The history of the world cannot, probably, furnish another instance of the settlement of the fundamental compact of a great nation under circumstances of so much obvious justice. This gives unusual solemnity and authority to the Constitution of 1787, and invests it with additional claims to our admiration and respect. The authority which formed the Constitution admitted, we come next to the examination of its acts. It is apparent from the debates and proceedings of the convention that two opinions existed in that body, the one leaning strongly toward the concentration of power in the hands of the federal government, and the other desirous of leaving as much as possible with the respective states. The principle that the powers which are not directly conceded to the Union should remain in first hands would seem never to have been denied, and some years after the organization of the government, it was solemnly recognized in an amendment. We are not disposed, however, to look for arguments to the debates and discussions of the convention, in our view often a deceptive and dangerous method of construing a law, since the vote is very frequently given on even conflicting reasons. Different minds arrive at the same results by different processes, and it is no unusual thing for men to deny each other's premises while they accept their conclusions. We shall look, therefore, solely to the compact itself as the most certain mode of ascertaining what was done. No one will deny that all the great powers of sovereignty are directly conceded to the Union. The right to make war and peace, to coin money, maintain armies and navies, and sea, in themselves overshadow most of the sovereignty of the states. The amendatory clause would seem to annihilate it. By the provisions of that clause, 3/4 of the states can take away all the powers and rights now resting in the hands of the respective states, with a single exception. This exception gives breadth and emphasis to the efficiency of the clause. It will be remembered that all this can be done within the present Constitution. It is a part of the original bargain. Thus, New York can legally be deprived of the authority to punish for theft, to lay out highways, to incorporate banks, and all the ordinary interests over which she at present exercises control, every human being within her limits dissenting. Now, as sovereignty means power in the last resort, this amendatory clause most clearly deprives the state of all sovereign power thus put at the disposition of conventions of the several states. In fact, the votes of these conventions, or that of the respective legislatures acting in the same capacity, is nothing but the highest species of legislation known to the country, and no other mode of altering the institutions would be legal. It follows unavoidably, we repeat, that the sovereignty which remains in the several states must be looked for solely in the exception. What then is this exception? It is a provision which says that no state may be deprived of its equal representation in the Senate without its own consent. It might well be questioned whether this provision of the Constitution renders a Senate indispensable to the government. But we are willing to concede this point and admit that it does. Can the vote of a single state, which is one of a body of 30, and which is bound to submit to the decision of a legal majority, be deemed a sovereign vote? Assuming that the whole power of the government of the United States were in the Senate, would any one state be sovereign in such a condition of things? We think not. But the Senate does not constitute by any means the whole or the half of the authority of this government. Its legislative power is divided with a popular body, without the concurrence of which it can do nothing. This dilutes the sovereignty to a degree that renders it very imperceptible, if not very absurd. Nor is this all. After a law is passed by the concurrence of the two houses of Congress, it is sent to a perfectly independent tribunal to decide whether it is in conformity with the principles of the Great National Compact, thus demonstrating, as we assume, that the sovereignty of this whole country rests not in its people, not in its states, but in the government of the Union. Sovereignty, and that of the most absolute character, is indispensable to the right of secession. Nay, sovereignty, in the ordinary acceptation of the meaning of the term, might exist in a state without this right of secession. We doubt if it would be held sound doctrine to maintain that any single state had a right to secede from the German Confederation, for instance, and many alliances, or mere treaties, are held to be sacred and indissoluble. They are only broken by an appeal to violence. Every human contract may be said to possess its distinctive character. Thus, marriage is to be distinguished from a partnership in trade, without recurrence to any particular form of words. Marriage, contracted by any ceremony whatever, is held to be a contract for life. The same is true of governments. In their nature they are intended to be indissoluble. We doubt if there be an instance on record of a government that ever existed, under conditions, expressed or implied, that the parts of its territory might separate at will. There are so many controlling and obvious reasons why such a privilege should not remain in the hands of sections or districts, that it is unnecessary to advert to them. But after a country has rounded its territory, constructed its lines of defense, established its system of custom houses, and made all the other provisions for security, convenience, and concentration that are necessary to the affairs of a great nation, it would seem to be very presumptuous to impute to any particular district the right to destroy or mutilate a system regulated with so much care. The only manner in which the right of secession could exist in one of the American states would be by an express reservation to that effect in the Constitution. There is no such clause. Did it exist, it would change the whole character of the government, rendering it a mere alliance, instead of being that which it now is, a lasting union. But, whatever may be the legal principles connected with this serious subject, there always exists, in large bodies of men, a power to change their institutions by means of the strong hand. This is termed the right of revolution, and it has often been appealed to redress grievances that could be removed by no other agency. It is undeniable that the institution of domestic slavery as it now exists in what are termed the southern and southwestern states of this country creates an interest of the most delicate and sensitive character. Nearly one half of the entire property of the slave-holding states consists in this right to the services of human beings of a race so different from our own as to render any amalgamation to the last degree improbable, if not impossible. Anyone may easily estimate the deep interest that the masters feel in the preservation of their property. The spirit of the age is decidedly against them, and of this they must be sensible. It doubly augments their anxiety for the future. the natural increase, moreover, of these human chattels renders an outlet indispensable, or they will soon cease to be profitable by the excess of their numbers. To these facts we owe the figments which have rendered the southern school of logicians a little presuming, perhaps, and certainly very sophistical. Among other theories we find the bold one, that the territories of the United States are the property, not of the several states, but of their individual people. In other words, that the native of New York or Rhode Island, regardless of the laws of the country, has a right to remove to any one of these territories, carry with him just such property as he may see fit, and make such use of it as he may find convenient. This is a novel co-partnership in jurisdiction, to say the least, and really does not seem worthy of a serious reply. The territory of the United States is strictly subject to the government. The only clause in the Constitution which refers to this interest conveys that meaning. But, were the instrument silent, the power would remain the same. Sovereignty of this nature is not determined by municipal law, but by the law of nations. Thus, for instance, the right to make war, which is inherent in every state of foreign relations, infers the right to secure its conquests. And that clause of the Constitution which declares that the war-making power shall abide in Congress, says, at the same time, by an unavoidable implication, that the national legislature shall have all authority to control the consequences of this war. It may dispose of its prisoners and its conquests according to its own views of policy and justice, subject only to the great principles that modern civilization has introduced into public concerns. One can understand why a different theory is in favor at the South. It would be very convenient, no doubt, to the slaveholder to be permitted to transfer his slaves to the gold diggings, and gather the precious metal in lieu of a crop of cotton. But this, the policy of the whole country forbids. Congress has very justly left the decision of this very important matter to the people of California itself, and they have almost unanimously raised their voices against the measure. This, after all, is the really sore point in controversy between the South and the North. The fugitive slave has been, and will be given up to the legal claims of his master, and, in a vast majority of the people of the North, there is no disposition to disturb the legislative compromise that has been made of this matter. It is true that the North still owes the South a great deal more, though it may be questioned if the machinations of demagogues and the ravings of fanaticism will permit it to discharge the obligation. Penal laws should be passed, punishing those who meddle with this grave interest out of the limits of the state in which the parties reside, and energy should be shown in rendering such an act of justice effective and sure. Good neighborhood, alone, would exact some such provision from every well-disposed community, and there cannot be a doubt that good policy coincides. The abolitionists, beyond a dispute, have only had a tendency to rivet the fetters of the slave, and to destroy the peace of the country. Emancipation has not been extended a single foot by any of their projects. While the whole South has been thrown into an attitude of hostile defiance, not only towards these misguided persons, but to their innocent and disgusted fellow citizens. There might be a hope that the well-intentioned portion of these people, and it is both numerous and respectable, could be induced to adopt a wiser mode of procedure, were it not that dissolute politicians, who care only for the success of parties, and who make a stalking horse of philanthropy, as they would of religion or patriotism, or any other extended feeling that happened to come within their influence, interpose their sinister schemes to keep agitation alive for their benefit. This, then, is the actual state of things, as between the North and the South. And we will take a hasty view of its probable consequences on the growth and commerce of the towns at the mouth of the Hudson. California equals California, newly conquered from Mexico, and where gold had been discovered in 1848, had in 1849 adopted a constitution banning slavery, at the same time that it applied for admission to the Union as a free state. It was admitted in 1850 as part of the so-called Compromise of 1850, which included the Fugitive Slave Act empowering the federal government to seize and return slaves fleeing from slave to free states. It is undeniable that any serious derangement of the political institutions of the country would produce a very injurious effect on its prosperity generally, and perhaps in its immediate influence, primarily on its commerce. But the first reverses of such a calamity overcome, we do not see reason for believing that the well-established principle that trade will make its own laws should not apply to these towns as well as to any other place known in the history of the world. New York, as has already been intimated, at this moment contributes quite as much to the prosperity of London as it would probably have done had the political connection between England and her colonies never been severed. Making allowances for the greater prosperity induced by the political independence of America, it is not improbable that she even contributes more. Society and trade enact their own laws. The first is found to be mainly independent of the influence of political power, and the same, with certain qualifications, may be said to be equally true of the last. But we see little to apprehend from this source of danger. If the slaveholding interest would be rendered really more secure by separation or secession, then, indeed, such a result might be looked for with some degree of confidence. But it is very certain that the measure would lead to an escape of most of the slaves near the northern frontiers of the Southern Confederacy, as well as of a vast number of those who live at a greater distance from what would probably be the dividing line. The North has been aroused to the necessity of being just and of adhering to the conditions of the Constitution. And the recent measures of the country go to prove there is no real disposition in the masses to do otherwise. The attachment to the Union is very strong and general throughout the whole of this vast country, and it is only necessary to sound the tocsin to bring to its maintenance a phalanx equal to uphold its standard against the assaults of any enemies. The impossibility of the Northwestern states consenting that the mouth of the Mississippi should be held by a foreign power is in itself a guarantee of the long existence of the present political ties. Then, the increasing and overshadowing power of the nation is of a character so vast, so exciting, so attractive, so well adapted to carry with it popular impulses, that men become proud of the name of American, and feel unwilling to throw away the distinction for any of the minor considerations of local policy. Every man sees and feels that a state is rapidly advancing to maturity which must reduce the pretensions of even ancient Rome to supremacy, to a secondary place in the estimation of mankind. A century will unquestionably place the United States of America prominently at the head of civilized nations, unless their people throw away their advantages by their own mistakes, the only real danger they have to apprehend. And the mind clings to this hope with a buoyancy and fondness that are becoming profoundly national. We have a thousand weaknesses, and make many blunders, beyond a doubt, as a people. But where shall we turn to find a parallel to our progress, our energy, and increasing power? That which it has required centuries, in other regions, to effect, is here accomplished in a single life. And the student in history finds the results of all his studies crowded as it might be into the incidents of the day. A great deal that has been done among us of late, doubtless remains to be undone. But we are accustomed to changes of this nature, and they do not seem to be accompanied by the same danger here as elsewhere. The people have yet to discover that the seeming throes of liberty are nothing but the breath of their masters, the demagogues, and that at the very moment when they are made to appear to have the greatest influence on public affairs, they really exercise the least. Here, in our view, is the great danger to the country which is governed, in fact, not by its people, as is pretended, but by factions that are themselves controlled most absolutely by the machinations of the designing. 100,000 electors, under the present system of caucuses and conventions, are just as much wielded by command as 100,000 soldiers in the field, and the wire pullers behind the scenes can as securely anticipate the obedience of their agents as the members of the bureau in any cabinet in Europe can look with confidence to the compliance of their subordinates. Party is the most potent despot of the times. Its very irresponsibility gives it an energy and weight that overshadows the regular action of government. And thus it is that we hear men, in their places in the national legislature, boasting of their allegiance to its interests and mandates, instead of referring their duties to the country. All large commercial towns are, in their nature, national in feeling. The diversity and magnitude of their interests are certain to keep them so, and, as we have already said, New York forms no exception to the rule. She belongs already more to the country than she does to the state, and every day has a tendency to increase this Catholic disposition among the votaries of commerce. That some extravagant notions, in which interest has thrown its mists before the reason of our people, exist, is, we think, undeniable. And we concede that the two recently promulgated figments of the equilibrium and the rights of persons over the property and territory of the United States have a character of feebleness and obvious delusion that would excite our wonder did we not have so many occasions to observe and comment on the frailty of human judgment when warped by motives of this nature. To us it would seem that the people of any particular state have just the same claim to use the ships of war and forts and public buildings of the United States as they have, unpermitted by the sovereign power, to occupy any of its lands. That which is the property of the public is no more the property of individuals, in law or reason, than the estate of any one man is the estate of his neighbor. Carry out the doctrine in spirit, and it would lead to general confusion, and a state of things so impracticable, as to disorganize society. If the people are thus intrinsically masters, and owners of all around them, why are they not the proprietors of the banks, and other corporations created by themselves? They made the government, if you will, though in a very limited capacity. And they made these corporations, much more directly and unequivocally, and, admitting the truth of this co-partnership principle, in which every man is so far a member of the firm that he may take his share of the assets, we cannot see that he is not equally entitled to lay his hands on all the other progeny of the popular will. In a word, the doctrine would seem to be not only weak, but absurd. And we find a difficulty in believing that any cool-headed and reflecting man can feel the necessity for refuting it.
Just the same claim equals Cooper is again ridiculing John C. Calhoun's assertion that, because the new territories of the West acquired from Mexico belonged to the people, rather than the federal government, Southerners had an inherent right to bring and keep their slaves in them regardless of federal law.
But other dangers undeniably beset the country that have no connection with this question of slavery. However repugnant it may be to the pride of human nature, or the favorite doctrines of the day, there can be little question that the greatest sources of apprehension of future evil to the people of this country are to be looked for in the abuses which have their origin in the infirmities and characteristics of human nature. In a word, the people have great cause to distrust themselves, and the numerous and serious innovations they are making on all sides, on not only the most venerable principles in favor with men, but on the divine law, must cause every reflecting man to forebode a state of things far more serious than even that which would arise from a separation of the states into isolated parts. The particular form in which this imminent danger is now, for the first time seriously since the establishment of the government, beginning to exhibit itself, is through the combinations of the designing to obtain a mercenary core of voters, insignificant as to numbers, but formidable by their union, to hold the balance of power and to effect their purposes by practicing on the willful, blind, wayward, and, we might almost add, fatal obstinacy of the two great political parties of the country. Here, in our view, is the danger that the nation has most to apprehend. The result is as plain as it is lamentable. In effect, it throws the political power of the entire republic into the hands of the intriguer, the demagogue, and the knave. Honest men are not practiced on by such combinations. But, with a fatality that would seem to be the very sport of demons, there they stand, drawn up in formidable array, in nearly equal lines of open and deriding hostility, leading those who no longer conceive it necessary to even affect the semblance of respect to many of the plainest and most important of the principles of social integrity that have ever been received among men. Anyone familiar with the condition of Europe must know that under the pressure of society in that quarter of the world, and toward which we are fast tending by a rapid accumulation of numbers, the present institutions of America, exercised under the prevalent opinions of the day, could not endure a 12-month. That which is now seen in France rendering real political liberty a mere stalking horse for the furtherance of the projects of the boldest adventurers, would inevitably be seen here. The bayonet alone would be relied on for the preservation of the nearest and dearest of human rights. There could and would be no other security for the peace of society, and that circle of power which, rising in the masses, ends in the scepter of the single despot, would once more be made as it might be in derision of all our efforts to be free.
Now seen in France equals following the French Revolution of 1848 Louis Napoleon Bonaparte 1808-1873,
nephew of the first Emperor Napoleon, had been elected as President of France, and was consolidating his power in December 1851. Shortly after Cooper's death, he would proclaim himself Emperor Napoleon III. If the existence of nations resembled that of individuals, it would not be difficult to foretell the consequences of this state of things. But communities may be said to have no lives, and are ever to be found occupying their places, and using the means assigned to them by Providence, whether free or enslaved, prosperous or the reverse. No one can foretell the future of this great country, in consequence of the extent and number of its outlets, each a provision of Providence, to put a check on revolutions and violence. The elements of a monarchy do not exist among us. The habits of the entire country are opposed to the reception of such a form of government. Nor do we know, bad as our condition is rapidly getting to be, strong as are the tendencies to social dissolution, and to the abuses which demand force to subdue, that anything would be gained by the adoption of any substitute for the present polity of the country, to be found in Europe. The abuses there are possibly worse than our own, and the only question would seem to be as to the degree of suffering and wrong to which men are compelled to submit through the infirmities of their own nature. There is one great advantage in the monarchical principle, when subdued by liberal institutions, as in the case of the government of that nation from which we are derived, which it would seem a republic cannot possess. We allude to the transmission of a nominal executive power that spares the turmoil, expense, and struggles of an election, and which answers all the purposes of the real authorities of the state in designating those who are to exercise the functions of rulers for the time being. It has often been predicted that the periodical elections of the chief magistrate of this country will, at no distant day, destroy the institutions. It would be idle to deny that the danger manifestly increases with the expedience of factions, and that there are very grave grounds for apprehending the worst consequences from this source of evil. As it now is, the working of the system has already produced a total departure from the original intention of the government, a scheme, probably, that was radically defective when adopted, and which contained the seeds of its own ruin. recourse to electors, has become an idle form, ponderous and awkward, and in some of its features uselessly hazardous. We are in the habit of comparing the cost of government in this country with that of other nations in the old world. Beyond a question, the Americans enjoy great advantages in this important particular, owing to their exemption from sources of expenses that weigh so heavily on those who rely for the peace of society solely on the strong hand. But confining the investigation simply to the cost of executives, it may well be questioned if we have not adopted the most expensive mode at present known among civilized nations. We entertain very little doubt that the cost of a presidential election fully equals the expenditures of the Empire of Great Britain, liberal as they are known to be, for the maintenance of the dignity of its chief magistracy. Nor is this the worst of it. For while much of the civil list of a monarch is usefully employed in cherishing the arts, and in fostering industry, to say nothing of its boons to the dependent, and meritorious in the shape of pensions, not a dollar of the millions that are wasted every fourth year among ourselves in the struggles of parties can be said to be applied to a purpose that is not a greater tendency to evil than to good. The simple publication of documents, perhaps, may form some exception to these abuses, but even they are so much filled with falsehoods, fallacies, audacious historical misstatements, exaggerations, and every other abuse naturally connected with such struggles, that we are compelled to yield them our respect and credulity with large allowances for caution and truth. Were this the place, and did our limits permit, we would gladly pursue this subject, for so completely has the hurrah of popular sway looked down everything like real freedom in the discussion of such a topic, as to render the voice of dissent almost unknown to us. But our purpose is merely to show what probable effects are to flow from the abuses of the institutions on the growth of the great commercial mart of which we are writing.
Recourse to electors equals the electoral college. We certainly think that even the looseness of law, legislation, and justice that is so widely spreading itself over the land is not exactly unsuited to sustain the rapid settlement of a country. No doubt men accomplish more in the earlier stages of society when perfectly unfettered than when brought under the control of those principles and regulations which alone can render society permanently secure or happy. In this sense, even the abuses to which we have slightly alluded may be tolerated, which it would be impossible to endure when the class of the needy become formidable from its numbers, and they who had no other stake in society than their naked assistance could combine to transfer the fruits of the labors of the more industrious and successful to themselves by a simple recurrence to the use of the ballot box. We do not say that such is to be the fate of this country, for the great results that seem to be dependent on its settlement raise a hope that the hand of Providence may yet guide us in safety through the period of delusion and the reign of political fallacies which is fast drawing around us. Evil is so much mixed with good in all the interests of life that it would be bold to pretend to predict consequences of such magnitude in Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.